Chapter 56. At about the same time that Flagg was consummating his infernal marriage to Nadine Cross, Lloyd Henreid was sitting alone in the Cub Bar, playing big clock solitaire and cheating. He was out of temper. There had been a flash fire at Indian Springs that day, one dead, three hurt, and one of those likely to die of bad flash burns. Carl Huff had brought the news. He had been pissed off to a high extreme, and he was not a man to be taken lightly. He had been a pilot for Ozark Airlines before the plague, was an ex-Marine, and he could have broken Lloyd in two pieces with one hand while mixing a daiquiri with the other if he had wanted to. Not that Lloyd was physically afraid of Carl. The pilot was big and tough, but he was as leery of the walkin' dude as anyone else in the West, and Lloyd wore Flagg's charm. But he was one of their flyers, and because he was, he had to be handled diplomatically. And oddly enough, Lloyd was something of a diplomat. His credentials were simple but awesome. He had spent several weeks with a certain madman named Poke Waxman, and had lived to tell the tale. He had also spent several months with Randall Flagg, and was still drawing air and in his right mind. Carl had come in around 2 on September 12th, his cycle helmet under one arm. There was an ugly burn on his left cheek and blisters on one hand. There had been a fire. Bad, but not as bad as it could have been. A fuel truck had exploded, spewing burning petroleum all over the tarmac area. "I don't think Freddy Campanari is going to live to see the sun go down. That leaves two pilots, me and Andy. Tell him that and tell him something else when he gets back. I want that fuck trash can man gone. That's my price for staying." Lloyd gazed at Carl Huff. "Is it? You're damn well told." "Well, I tell you, Carl," Lloyd said, "I can't pass that message on. If you want to give orders to him, you'll have to do it yourself." Carl looked suddenly confused and a little afraid, and fear sat strangely on that craggy face. "Yeah, I see your point. I'm fucked over, Lloyd. My face hurts like hell. I don't mean to take it out on you."
"That's okay, man. It's what I'm here for."
Sometimes he wished it wasn't. Already his head was starting to ache. Carl said, "But he's gotta go. If I have to tell him that, I will. I know he's got one of those black stones. He's ace high with the big man, I guess. But hey, listen." Carl sat down and put his helmet on a baccarat table. "Trash was responsible for that fire. My Christ, how are we ever going to get those planes up if one of the big guy's men is torching the fucking pilots?" Several people passing through the lobby of the Grand glanced uneasily over at the table where Lloyd and Carl sat.
"Keep your voice down, Carl."
"Okay. But you see the problem, don't you?"
"How sure are you the trash did it?"
"He was in the motor pool. Lots of guys saw him, including me."
"I thought he was out someplace in the desert."
"He came back. That sand crawler he takes out was full of stuff. God knows where he gets it. Well, he had the guys in stitches at coffee break. You know how he is. To him, weaponry is like candy is to a kid. The last thing he showed us was one of those incendiary fuses. You pull the tab and there's this little burst of phosphorus. There's nothing for half an hour or 40 minutes, depending on the size of the fuse. Then there's one hell of a fire, small but very intense."
"Yeah?"
"So Trashy was just drooling over it, and Freddy Campanari says, 'Hey, people who play with fire wet the bed, Trash.' And Steve Tobin, you know him, he's funny like a screen door in a submarine, he says, 'You guys better put away your matches, Trashy's back in town.' And Trash got really weird. He looked around at us, and he muttered under his breath. I was sitting right next to him, and it sounded like he said, 'Don't ask me about old Lady Semple's check no more.' That make any sense to you?" Lloyd shook his head. "Then he just left. Picked up the stuff he was showing us and took off. Well, none of us felt very good about it. We didn't mean to hurt his feelings. Most of the guys really like Trash. Or they did. He's like a little kid. An hour later, that fuel truck goes up like a rocket. And while we were picking up the pieces, I happened to look up, and there's Trashy over in the sand crawler by the barracks building, watching us with binoculars."
"Is that all you've got?" Lloyd asked, relieved.
"No, but it got me thinking about how that truck went up.
That's just the sort of thing you use an incendiary fuse for. In Nam, the Kong blew up a lot of our ammo dumps just that way, with our own fucking incendiary fuses. The only thing that didn't fit was there's always a dozen fuel trucks in the motor pool, and we don't use them in any particular order. So after we got poor old Freddy over to the infirmary, John Waits and I went over there. John's in charge of the motor pool, and he was just about pissing himself. He'd seen trash in there earlier. He was sure it was Trash Can Man? With those burns all the way up his arm, it's kind of hard to make a mistake, wouldn't you say? No one thought anything of it then. He was just poking around, and that's his job, ain't it? Yes, I guess you'd have to say it is. So me and John start to look over the rest of the fuel trucks. And holy shit, there's an incendiary fuse in every one of them. He put them on the exhaust pipes just below the fuel tanks themselves. The reason the truck we were using went first was because the exhaust pipe got hot. But the others were getting ready. Two or three were starting to smoke. Some of the trucks were empty, but at least five of them were full of jet fuel. Another 10 minutes and we would have lost half the goddamn base. Oh, Jesus, Lloyd thought mournfully. Carl held up his blistered hand. I got this pulling one of the hot ones. Now do you see why he's got to go? Lloyd said, maybe someone stole those fuses out of the back of his sandcrawler while he was taking a leak or something. Carl said patiently, that's not how it happened. Someone hurt his feelings while he was showing off his toys, and he tried to burn us all up. He damn near succeeded. Something's got to be done, Lloyd. All right, Carl. He spent the rest of the afternoon asking around about trash. Had anyone seen him or know where he might be? Guarded looks and negative answers. Word had gotten around. Maybe that was good. Anyone who did see him would be quick to report it in hopes of having a good word put in on their behalf with the big guy. But Lloyd had a hunch that no one was going to see Trash. He had given them a little hot foot and had gone running into the desert in his sand crawler. He looked down at the solitaire game spread out in front of him and carefully controlled an urge to sweep the whole thing onto the floor. Instead, he cheated out another ace and went on playing. It didn't matter. Trashy was going to end up riding a crosspiece. Hard luck, guy. But in his secret heart, he wondered. Things had happened lately that he didn't like. Dana, for instance. Flag had known about her, that was true, but she hadn't talked. She had somehow escaped into death instead, leaving them no further ahead in the matter of the third spy. How come he didn't just know about the third spy? He had known about the old fart, and when he had come back from the desert, he had known about Dana, and had told them exactly how he was going to handle her. But it hadn't worked. And now, Trash Can Man. Trash wasn't a nobody. He wore the black man's stone just as he himself did. After Flag had crisped the big-mouth lawyer's brains in L.A., Lloyd had seen Flag lay his hands on Trash Can's shoulders and tell him gently that all the dreams had been true dreams. And Trash had whispered, "My life for you." Lloyd didn't know what else might have passed between them, but it seemed clear that he had wandered the desert with Flag's blessing. And now Trash Can Man had gone berserk, which raised some pretty serious questions. Which was why Lloyd was sitting here alone at 9 in the evening, cheating at solitaire and wishing he was drunk. "Mr. Henreid?" "Now what?" He looked up and saw a girl with a pretty pouty face, tight white shorts, a halter that didn't quite cover the aureole of her nipples. Sexpot type for sure, but she looked nervous and pale, almost ill. She was biting compulsively at one of her thumbnails, and he saw that all her nails were bitten and ragged. "What?" I have to see Mr. Flag," she said. The strength went rapidly out of her voice, and it ended as a whisper. "You do, huh? What do you think I am, a social secretary?" "But they said to see you." "Who did?" "Well, Angie Hirschfield did. It was her." "What's your name?" Julie. She giggled, but it was only a reflex. The scared look never left her face, And Lloyd wondered wearily what sort of shit was up in the fan now. A girl like this wouldn't ask for Flag unless it was very serious indeed. Julie Lowry. Well, Julie Lowry, Flag isn't in Las Vegas now. When will he be back? I don't know. He comes and goes. He doesn't explain himself to me. If you have something, give it to me and I'll see that he gets the message. She looked at him doubtfully, and Lloyd repeated what he had told Carl Huff that afternoon. It's what I'm here for, Julie. Okay. Then, in a rush, if it's important, you tell him I'm the one who told you, Julie Lowry. Okay. You won't forget? No, for Christ's sake, what is it? She pouted. Well, you don't have to be so mean about it. He sighed and put the handful of cards he had been holding down on the table. No, he said, I guess I don't. Now, what is it? That dummy. If he's around, I figure he's spying. I just thought you should know. Her eyes glinted viciously. Motherfucker pulled a gun on me. What dummy? Well, I saw the retard, so I figured the dummy must be with him, you know. And they're just not our type. I figure they must have come from the other side. That's what you figure, huh? Yeah. Well, I don't know what the Christ you're talking about. It's been a long day and I'm tired. If you don't start talking some sense, Julie, I'm going to bed. Julie sat down, crossed her legs, and told Lloyd about her meeting with Nick Andros and Tom Cullen, about the episode of the Pepto-Bismol. I was just having a little fun with the softy, and this deaf and dumb pulls a gun on me. She even told him about shooting at them as they left town. Which all proves what? Lloyd asked when she finished. He had been a little intrigued with the word spy, but since then had lapsed into a semi-daze of boredom. Julie pouted again and lit a cigarette. I told you, that Phoebe, he's over here now. I just bet he's spying. Tom Cullen, you said his name was? Yes. He had the vaguest sort of memory. Cullen was a big blonde guy, a few cards short the deck for sure, but surely not as bad as this high iron bitch was making out. He tried for more and came up empty. People were still streaming into Vegas in numbers of 60 to 100 a day. It was becoming impossible to keep them all straight, and Flagg said the immigration was going to get a lot heavier before it tapered off. He supposed he would go to Paul Burleson, who was keeping a file of Vegas residents, and find something out about this Cullen dude. Are you going to arrest him? Julie asked. Lloyd looked at her. I'll arrest you if you don't get off my case, he said. Nice fucking guy, Julie cried, her voice rising shrewishly. She jumped to her feet, glaring at him. In her tight white cotton shorts, her legs seemed to go all the way up to her chin. Try to do you a favor. I'll check it. Yeah, right, I know that story. She stomped off, Fanny swinging in tight little circles of indignation. Lloyd watched her with a certain weary amusement, thinking there were a lot of chicks like her in the world. Even now, after the superflu, he was willing to bet there were a lot around. Easy to slap the make on, but watch out for the fingernails afterward. Kissing cousins to those spiders that gobble up their mates after sex. 2 months had gone by, and she still bore that mute guy a grudge. Lloyd pulled a battered black notebook from his back pocket, wet his finger, and paged over to a blank sheet. This was his memory book, and it was chock full of little notes to himself. Everything from a reminder to take a shave before meeting with Flag, to a boxed memorandum to get the contents of Las Vegas's pharmacies inventoried before they started to lose morphine and codeine. It would be time to get another little book soon. In his flat and scrawling grammar school script, he wrote, Nick Andros, mute, in town? And below that, Tom Cullen, check out with Paul. He tucked the book back into his pocket. 40 miles northeast, the dark man had consummated his long-term relationship with Nadine Cross under the glittering desert stars. He would have been very interested to know that a friend of Nick Andros's was in Las Vegas. But he slept. Lloyd looked morosely down at his solitaire game, forgetting about Julie Lowry and her grudge and her tight little ass. He cheated out another ace, and his thoughts turned dolefully back to the trash can man and what Flag might say or do when Lloyd told him. At the same time Julie Lowry was leaving the Cub Bar, Tom Cullen stood by the picture window of his apartment in another part of the city, looking dreamily out at the full moon. It was time to go. Time to go back. This apartment was not like his house in Boulder. This place was furnished, but not decorated. He had not put up so much as a single poster or hung a single stuffed bird from piano wire. This place had only been a way station, and now it was time to go on. He was glad. He hated it here. It had a kind of smell to it here, a dry and rotten smell that you never quite could put your finger on. The people were mostly nice, and some of them he liked every bit as well as the people in Boulder, folks like Angie and that little boy, Dinny. No one made fun of him because he was slow. They had given him a job and joked with him, and on lunch break they'd trade out of their dinner buckets for something out of someone else's that looked better. They were nice folks. Not much different from Boulder folks, as far as he could tell, but they had that smell about them. They all seemed to be waiting and watching. Sometimes strange silences fell among them, and their eyes seemed to glaze over, as if they were all having the same uneasy dream. They did things without asking for explanations of why they were doing them or what it was for. It was as if these people were wearing happy folks' faces, but their real underneath faces were monster faces. He had seen a scary movie about that once. That kind of monster was called a werewolf. The moon rode over the desert, ghostly, high, and free. He had seen Dana from the free zone. He had seen her once and never again. What had happened to her? Had she been spying, too? Had she gone back? He didn't know, but he was afraid. There was a small knapsack in the chair that faced the apartment's useless color console TV. It was full of vacuum-sealed ham strips and Slim Jims and saltines. He picked up the knapsack and put it on. Travel at night, sleep in the day. He stepped out into the courtyard of the building without a backward glance. The moon was so bright that he cast a shadow on the cracked cement where the would-be high rollers had once parked their cars with the out-of-state plates. He looked up at the ghostly coin that floated in the sky. M-O-O-N, that spells moon, he whispered. Laws, yes. Tom Cullen knows what that means. His bike was leaning against the pink stucco wall, and he got on and set off for the interstate. By 11 p.m., he had cleared Las Vegas and was pedaling east in the breakdown lane of I-15. No one saw him. No alarm was raised. His mind dropped into a soft neutral. He biked steadily along, conscious only that the light night breeze felt nice against his sweaty face. Every now and then, he had to swerve around a sand dune that had crept out of the desert and had lain a white skeletal arm across the road. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, Glenn Bateman might have said in his ironic way. He stopped at 2 a.m. for a light lunch of Slim Jims, crackers, and Kool-Aid from the big thermos strapped to the back of the bike. Then he went on. The moon was down. Las Vegas fell further behind with every revolution of his bicycle tires. That made him feel good. But at 4:15 on that morning of September 13th, a cold comber of fear washed over him. It was made all the more terrifying by virtue of its unexpectedness, by its seeming irrationality. Tom would have cried out loud, but his vocal cords were suddenly frozen, locked. The muscles in his pumping legs went slack, and he coasted along under the stars. The black and white negative of the desert streamed by more and more slowly. He was near. The man with no face, the demon who now walked the earth. Flag. The grinning man. Only when his grin fell on you, all the blood in your body fell into a dead swoon, leaving your flesh cold and gray. The man who could look at a cat and make it puke up hairballs. If he walked through a building project, men would hammer their own thumbnails and put shingles on upside down and sleepwalk off the ends of girders and oh, dear God, he was awake. A whimper escaped Tom's throat. He could feel the sudden wakefulness. He seemed to see, feel, an eye opening in the darkness of the early morning, a dreadful red eye that was still a bit bleared and confused with sleep. It was turning in the darkness, looking for him.
It knew Tom Cullen was there, but not just where he was. Numbly, his feet found the pedals, and he biked on, faster and faster, bending over the handlebars to cut down the wind resistance, picking up speed until he was nearly flying along. If he had come upon a wrecked car in his path, he would have pedaled into it full tilt and perhaps killed himself. But little by little, he could feel that dark, hot presence falling behind him. And the greatest wonder was that that awful red eye had glanced his way, had passed over him without seeing. "Maybe because I'm bent over my handlebars so far," Tom Cullen reasoned incoherently. And then it had closed. The dark man had gone back to sleep. How does the rabbit feel when the shadow of the hawk falls on him like a dark crucifix and then goes on without stopping or even slowing? How does the mouse feel when the cat who has been crouched patiently outside his hole for the entire day is picked up by its master and tossed unceremoniously out the front door? How does the deer feel when it steps quietly past the mighty hunter who is snoozing away the effects of his 3 lunchtime beers? Perhaps they feel nothing. Or perhaps they feel what Tom Cullen felt as he rode out of that black and dangerous sphere of influence. A great and nearly electrifying sunburst of relief. A feeling of new birth. Most of all, a feeling of safety scarcely earned, that such great good luck must surely be a sign from heaven. He rode on until 5 o'clock in the morning. Ahead of him, the sky was turning the dark blue laced with gold of sunrise. The stars were fading. Tom was almost done in. He went on a little further and spotted a sharp decline about 70 yards to the right of the highway. He pushed his bike over to it. Consulting the tickings and workings of instinct, he pulled enough dry grass and mesquite to cover most of the bike. There were 2 big rocks leaning against each other about 10 yards from his bike. He crawled into the pocket of shade beneath them, put his jacket under his head, and was asleep almost at once.